Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. Thanks so much for joining me today. We will continue our conversations today on the third article, how the Holy Spirit works faith, creates faith in us, and it's all God's doing and nothing of our own. The topics that we have lined up today are actually more about family, but you'll see how it relates to the third article, how the Holy Spirit works faith in us, as he uses the means of this first article gift of the family. So we're going to talk with Dr. Vern Bengtson. He is a professor at USC, University of Southern California, and sociology. We'll talk with him about a study of how faith is passed on from one generation to the next. And then during the second half, we'll talk with Reverend Dr. Peter Steinke on family systems theory. So I hope you can stick around for that conversation and how God works in our families. Thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting this program. To find out more, go to our website, kfuo.org. Look for the CUW logo in the sponsor section and check out Concordia University, Wisconsin. Our listener lines are closed today as the program has been pre-recorded. I hope that you enjoy the conversation. Today, our guest is Dr. Vern Bengtson. He is research professor of social work at the University of Southern California and also the AARP University Professor of Gerontology and Sociology Emeritus. He's also the author of Families and Faith, which is published in 2013 by Oxford University Press. Good morning, Dr. Bengtson.
Good morning. Good morning.
Thanks so much for being our guest today on Faith and Family.
It's a pleasure.
Now, you've invested quite a bit of time and energy, just years, in researching how religion is passed down across generations. What led up to your interest and research in this area?
Well, for many years, I've been studying families in terms of mental health and in terms of psychological well-being. And I've also been interested in transmission between generations of values and issues like politics and attitudes towards sex and attitudes towards work. And among those issues that I've been studying are religion. Just recently, though, I got a grant from the John Templeton Foundation to look at the intergenerational transmission of religion. So we started out by looking at the 35 years of data that we gathered from over 350 families to see whether or not there was a degree of transmission, generations passing on religious values and beliefs to their children and to their grandchildren, and whether the degree of that transmission, that similarity, had decreased between 1970, when we first started gathering this data, and 2005, which is the latest data point of collection.
So in your research, if I understand correctly, what you were looking for is, does a subsequent generation share the same faith as their parents or grandparents?
That's right. One example is we wanted to know whether a Presbyterian father and mother in 1970 had children who were Presbyterians in 1990 mm-hmm. and grandchildren who were Presbyterians in 2005.
Tell us about the study you conducted. How was the information collected? I can imagine that to conduct such research would be quite an undertaking. How was this information gathered?
Yes, it was quite an undertaking. We started out with 350 families, over 2,000 individuals who were grandparents or middle-aged parents or young adult grandchildren, about average age of 19. And we followed these people, interviewing them every 3 years. So we had a lot of data, and we had to keep these people interested in the study so that they continued to respond. And we sent them birthday cards, and we sent them Christmas cards, and we sent them reports of the study. So we were able to keep most of the respondents around. And then in 1991, we started interviewing the great-grandchildren of the original grandparents, and we kept adding the great-grandchildren to the sample as they turned age 16.
So you really studied several generations in this, not just one from parents to children, but also across grandchildren and great grandchildren. That's quite a collection of information.
That's right. It's a 4-generation study. It's the only one of its kind. It's unique in that regard.
In your study, what religious groups did you study? What were the groups, religious faith groups that you studied?
Well, we studied just about every faith group that is represented in significant numbers in American society. Catholics, evangelical Protestants, what is called mainline Protestants, that is Presbyterians and Methodists and Episcopalians, Mormons, Jews, people who do not have any religious affiliation whatsoever. We did not have Buddhists or Muslims in the sample.
Out of that selection of groups, what was the most intriguing out of those groups? Was there anything specific that stood out about any of those specific groups?
Yes, it was very interesting to see which religious groups had the highest transmission between generations and which religious groups did not have as high transmission. First, I should note that we were surprised at how high the degree of transmission was over all the sample. We were surprised at how many families had faith that was the same between generations and how many parents appeared to be successful in passing on their faith to children. But among the religious groups, the highest in terms of transmission, the most effective religious groups were the Mormons. They had a success rate, if you call it that, mm-hmm. of about 80 to 86% in terms of keeping their children in the Mormon faith. The second highest group were Jews. But there the situation is a little bit complicated because there were religious Jews and there were secular Jews. And the secular Jews, many of them were atheists or agnostics. But when you ask, what is your religion, they responded, Jewish, because of the ethnic and cultural identification with Jewish definitions. The third highest religious group in terms of transmission were evangelicals, and they too had a fairly high rate of intergenerational similarity, intergenerational transmission. Catholics were not nearly as high as the other groups, nor were Presbyterians and Episcopalians and Methodists.
Was there something significant? Was the study able to identify what were some of the practices or traits or qualities that that contributed to that successful transmission from one generation to the next?
Yes. In terms of Mormons, they're one religious group that in which religion and family is so connected, so intertwined, that almost all religious activities are family-centered. Every Monday night, everywhere in the world, every Mormon family gets together. The children get together with the adults, and they spend an hour or more on Bible study and prayer and religious teachings. So many Mormon activities are family-centered, family togetherness. And so the whole idea of afterlife, of Mormon heaven, is reuniting with your family. Families are bonded together in the church for eternity. You baptize ancestors so that they're going to be present with you in heaven. It's a very family-oriented religion. And the same is true, although not nearly to the extent, of Jewish rituals, Jewish holidays, the Sabbath. There's a family ceremony. Family get-togethers are, religious in nature in many cases. Evangelicals too place a lot of emphasis on families and family activities. So there's a institutional amalgamation of families and religion that is characteristic of those three religious traditions, which is not the same, which is not present in Catholics or Methodists, let's say. So that reinforces the intergenerational transmission, and that's kind of on a faith basis.
So in those religious groups, in Mormons, Jews, and evangelicals, there were, within those religions, structures that really emphasized, even required family time, if you will. And that was key, that family time, or the emphasis on family, the cultural practices that emphasize families doing something together on a regular basis, religious instruction or some sort of cultural activity together on a regular basis, it was key in those families passing on that faith.
Yes, absolutely. Mormons, for example, have Saturday seminars for parents about how to interact, how to better educate, raise your children in the faith. And the contrast is with a lot of Protestant Christian churches. They're age-segregated in their programs. They have Sunday schools for different age levels. They have activities for junior high school. They have activities for high school students. They have activities for college students. They have activities for young married. Activities in some cases for older adults. But where are the activities for whole families? I've never heard a sermon in a Protestant church about how to keep your children in the faith, how to promote intergenerational transmission. It's just not nearly as important an issue, as acknowledged an issue, even though it would be very salient if you asked people, is it important for your children to be in the same faith as you? It's just not institutionally important. Methodist and Lutheran ministers just don't think about it that much in terms of their programming.
So specifically the religious groups that took an intergenerational approach to their faith and their practices were more successful in passing on their faith, their values, and their traditions to the next generation.
Yes, yes. But then I've been talking about the churches that are more effective in programming. You asked also about whether there are some characteristics on the part of parents that are more effective in passing on the faith. And our research found three things that are predictive of whether or not a child is going to practice the same faith as the parents. The first, of course, is the sort of tradition, the situation, the inheritance that a child is born into. If it's a mixed marriage, we found there are much lower rates of intergenerational transmission than if the parents are of the same faith. And that's pretty obvious. If the parents are not active in a church, it's pretty obvious that they're not going to transmit with a high degree of certainty the religious practices that the parents came from. So that's one factor. The second factor is also fairly obvious. If the parents don't practice very much, if they're not involved in a church very much, if they don't tell the kids very much about the Bible, about the sacred text, about the church traditions, they're not as likely to pass on their faith as parents who do, parents who are actively involved, parents who are consistent in their faith. So You can call that role modeling, and that's the second factor that's very important. But here's a third factor. Ministers, youth leaders, talk a lot about the second thing. They tell parents they should be involved, that children will pattern themselves after a parent who is church-going and who lives a holy life. They don't talk about the third factor, which has to do with emotional closeness. We found that this is the biggest predictor of whether or not a child follows a parent in religion. The warmth, the quality of the relationship with the parent, that turns out to be crucial, especially the relationship with the father. A cold, authoritarian father is much less likely to have a child follow him in the faith than a warm, affirming father.
Interesting to hear that. The three things that were significant was, starting from the bottom, the relationship with the father. If there was a warm relationship with parents, especially with the father, they were more likely to share the same faith as parents.
Yes.
Parents setting an example and regularly practicing what they believe, and setting an example, demonstrating, talking about what they believe, reading the scriptures together. And what was the first one?
Yes. The first one is, you can call it religious inheritance. And that's something that the kid can't do much about, and the parents can't do much about once after they're married. But same-faith marriages, for example, divorce also. Mm-hmm. If the parents are divorced, that often disrupts intergenerational transmission of religion.
Looking at society as a whole, did you find that changes in American society over time had much effect on the faith of each subsequent generation?
That's what we were really surprised by. No. And we found that there was not... we expected there to be less evidence of intergenerational transmission in 2005 than there was in 1970. And that's because, as you just indicated, there have been so many social changes between 1970 and the year 2005. Religion has changed. Society has changed. There's so much more media impact on young people today than there was in 1970. But what we found was that the degree of similarity between parents and children religiously was about the same today as it was 3.5 decades ago. And that was a real surprise.
I was just thinking that the difference in from 1970 to 2005 in terms of the family and what makes up the family, were you able to see if... or did it come out in your research that there were more families with a mother and a father in 1970 and today more families with just a single parent or more divorced families? Were there any nuances like that came up in the research?
Well, what's interesting is, contrary to popular opinion, the divorce rate in 1970 was about the same as it is in 2005. It was in the 1960s that the divorce rate went up. It is slightly higher today than it was back then. And there is more incidence of people who never married. See, that's the big thing. That's the big change between 1970 and 2005. It's not the divorce rate. It is the degree of people who have and do not marry and who have children in a single state. But we didn't have many of those in our sample because this phenomena has occurred in the 1990s and 2000s, and the youngest people in our sample were born in 1988. Difference in our sample we did find differences between children of divorced parents and children of intact families, and there was less intergenerational transmission in among the children of divorce.
Hmm. What can we learn from those whose faith was not passed on to the next generation in your research? What can we learn from that group?
Well, there's one thing I haven't mentioned. We classified those kids, those young adults, who were not similar to their parents, into three categories. The first we called religious rebels. They were the children from very devout parents who had rejected religion or gone into a very different religion. They rebelled against their parents. The second category is kind of interesting. They're the children of parents who are not religious, but they had converted and become very religious. And the third category we called the prodigals. Those are the children of parents who had rebelled and then come back to the faith. Three really different outcomes. Then we looked at the whole sample, you know, not just the kids, but tracing the trajectory of people over 35 years. And what we found there, when we looked at the people who were young in 1970, a lot of them had no religion at that time. They were religious rebels. But a lot of them turned out to be prodigals. They came back. And we found over the lifespan that religiosity increased with age. So the first thing I would tell parents who are worried about their kids being religious rebels and dropping out is be patient. A lot of people, a lot of kids who drop out of religion eventually come back.
What does this research speak to clergy? You've mentioned what it shares for parents and I would gather for grandparents as well. What would you share with clergy from this?
I would say to clergy, pay attention to families. Pay attention to intergenerational transmission. Don't be nearsighted and just focus on age groups. Focus on age spans. And it's just tragic to me the way we ignore families in Catholic and most Protestant churches. Intergenerational transmission is very important, and the life cycle is very important. Another thing that I think is tragic is the way most churches ignore elderly people, grandparents. Grandparents are enormously important religiously in the lives of children. The popular notion is that mainline churches and Catholic churches too are losing members right and left. Well, there is a group out there that has the potential for filling the pews of Protestant and Catholic churches. They're middle-aged and elderly people who will experience more interest in religion and spiritual things as they age. I call this kind of a retirement surge in religiosity. And our data show that after people retire, they have more time and they have more interest in things that are spiritual. And churches aren't taking advantage of that.
Anything else in your research that you found that you'd like to share with us today as we're wrapping up our time?
I just think that parents should be patient. They should let their kids be more open with religion. If they want their children to follow them in faith, they should allow them to choose their own way. And they should be warm and affirming and recognize that people find God in different ways.
We've been talking with Dr. Vern Bengtson. He is the research professor of social work at the University of Southern California and also the AARP University Professor of Gerontology and Sociology Emeritus at USC. He's also the author of Families and Faith, published in 2013 by Oxford University Press. Dr. Bengtson, thanks so much for being our guest today on Faith and Family.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Stick around for more Faith and Family. We'll talk with Reverend Dr. Peter Steinke about family systems theory right after this break.
Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin, overlooks the beautiful shoreline of Lake Michigan. This serene main campus of CUW is just 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with all its vibrant cultural attractions. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, students living by the motto of inspiration and action can choose from 69 undergraduate majors, 14 master degree programs, and doctorates in pharmacy, physical therapy, and nursing practice. For more information or to take a virtual tour, visit cuw.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
When it rains, it pours. But this time, I'm talking about pouring down blessings. Sarah and Andy Justice of Tulsa, Oklahoma, had trouble conceiving, but were blessed by adopting a beautiful set of triplets. No sooner had this blessing been realized, they were informed another was on the horizon. The couple found out they were expecting twins. In the space of only 9 months, a normal pregnancy, Sarah and Andy were blessed with 5 infants. You could say it was raining babies from heaven. Their church family stepped up to cook meals. Friends and family rotated to help Sarah while Andy was at work. The 300 diapers required each week have all been donated. I have no doubt that God will provide for all of their needs throughout this family's life. Children are a blessing from God.
Life Issues. Stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.
The Lutheran Elementary School Association has awarded nearly $7 million in scholarships to help make Lutheran education affordable. Join us at the Knights for Kids 10th Annual Tribute Dinner Auction, Saturday, April 5th at the St. Louis Marriott West. Help a child attend Lutheran schools in our community, LESA 314-268-1525, or visit us at lesastl.org. All gifts will be matched dollar for dollar by the Lutheran Foundation of St. Louis.
With the next broadcast of Law and Gospel being an open mic Friday, it is your turn to call us at 1-800-730-2727, either to ask a question or make a comment on any of the subjects covered during the week, such as Jewish missions, Jesus and Nicodemus, or any other theological topic on your mind.
Weekday mornings beginning at 9:30 on KFUO.
Have you ever thought about becoming a worldwide KFUO Day sponsor? There are plenty of reasons to do so. Perhaps a birthday, an anniversary, celebration of a baptism, confirmation, graduation, any event. It's easy. Just call Mary or Joni at 1-800-844-0524. That's 800-844-0524. And become a worldwide KFUO Day sponsor today.
The bishop who oversees the storefront church destroyed by Wednesday's building explosion in New York says it's been there for decades and recently celebrated its 80th birthday.
It's a lot of prayer going on. We're getting a lot of support from a lot of pastors that have already called us, a lot of friends. And whatever we have to do to rebuild, we're going to do it.
The Spanish Christian Church was in one of the two buildings flattened by the blast, apparently caused by a gas leak. Several people were killed and more than 30 were injured. Bishop Fernando Rodriguez says the congregation was trying to locate church members who lived in the building. Some turned out to be at work. Others were hospitalized. Rodriguez says it reminds him of when he was a chaplain during the 9/11 terrorist attacks.
Like I said in 9/11, you know, God is in control and he would strain everything out. What we don't understand today, when the air clears and everything clears, we'll be able to see his glory in everything.
Now, as then, he says it's important to trust God for healing and restoration. I'm Steve Coleman.
Today we're talking with Reverend Dr. Peter Steinke. He's a congregational systems consultant who's also served as a parish pastor and educator and therapist for clergy. He's the author of How Your Church Family Works and Healthy Congregations. Good morning, Dr. Steinke.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being our guest on Faith and Family today.
Pleasure.
I'd like to talk about the topic of family systems theory. You've done research and very knowledgeable in this area, but I don't know if our listeners are familiar with it, and I'm just briefly familiar with it. Can you give us just a brief summary or definition of what family systems theory is?
Sure. Family systems is a way of looking at how human beings interact, and what happens in families also happens in workplaces and recreation times. Congregations also, and a lot of it has to say your behavior influences mine and my behavior influences yours. So it's how the interaction takes place between people. Also, the person that I studied with, Dr. Edwin Friedman, based his theory from a theorist called Murray Bowen. So there are different lines of thought and systems. So what I'm going to be talking about is mostly how Bowen understood family systems. But it's understanding that human interaction is important in all that we do because we influence each other's behaviors.
What led up to your interest to study this and pursue it now, serve in the various ways that you do using family systems theory?
Well, I had a position called Director of Clergy Care with Lutheran Social Services of the South, and I was doing therapy just with Lutheran clergy and members of their families. And I wasn't really trained in this way of thinking, and I wasn't really interested in it. But I came upon this Jewish rabbi named Edwin Friedman, who presented it in a way that I said, you know, this really makes sense. So I followed that up with studying with Dr. Friedman in Bethesda, Maryland, for about 9 years. So that's how it developed. Not that I was looking for it, but this individual just drew my interest.
So it's not that you were looking for it. It kind of found you.
It kind of found me, right?
You mentioned there are a couple of different approaches to family systems theory. Where did this? Where did family systems theory originate?
Well, about 50 years ago, there was a group of people. It happened almost simultaneously. Began to say, you know, that human problems stem more from the interaction between people than necessarily something in terms of the internal depth of persons. And so they began to look at what happens when people come together and function in certain kinds of ways. So one of the emphases in any family systems theory would be how do people function in certain situations. In some situations, they may function in a more anxious way, in another situation, less anxious way. And people want to know, well, what creates that? Part of it is formatted in our families, our own families. And, you know, this goes back to the scriptural idea that the sins of the fathers are visited upon the third and fourth generation. In systems theory, that's called the multi-generational transmission process. So there's been thoughts about this in the past, that how we have been raised, how we've been trained, how we observe other people, it gets into our functioning too.
So family systems theory doesn't necessarily originate in a Christian worldview, but it certainly is something that that Christians can use as a first article gift, if you will.
Well, it was very interesting because my mentor was a Jewish rabbi, but it has so many parallels to the Christian faith and how we understand ourselves that most of the people who came to the training with Dr. Freeman were from the Christian background.
So how is it useful to Christians today? How is it useful go ahead.
Yeah, I think what Derek DeBowen did is gave us some concepts by which we can understand our functioning. So let me just list two of them I think are important. One is what he called the emotional system. And by the term emotional, he meant anything in our behavior that is automatic, instinctual, reflexive. There's no thought to it. It just comes with our DNA. It's automatic behavior. That's the emotional system. And no matter where you are interacting with people, there's an emotional system that goes on. And all emotional systems are very sensitive to anxiety. And when anxiety is elevated, our behavior is more emotional. That is, it's more instinctual than reflective, thought out, and chosen. So Dr. Freeman had an interesting formula. He called it HE equals RO. By that he meant the hostility of the environment is proportionate to the response of the organism, which means the number and the strength of the stressors is not what is most important in any relationship. It's how do you respond to it? Do you do it with some reflection and choice, or do you do it with just high reactive behavior, which is instinctual and in many cases simply defensive? That's one of the key ideas.
So how we react to our environment, how we react to those around us, can be very instinctual, or as you said, can be
It's either thought out, planned, chosen, or it just comes out of the automatic equipment that we have as human beings, yeah.
So, and some of us are wired more one way than the other when it comes to this. Is this something that may change over time?
It can. You may be sensitive to certain things, and therefore your anxiety would rise higher than mine. And vice versa, some other situation, my anxiety may go higher because of a situation. And part of it has to do with our past experiences. Part is how our family has handled it. And part of it is just how I perceive what's going on around me. Is it a threat? Or is this something I can really affect by through my behavior?
So there are several contributing factors to what our disposition is, in a sense. It sounds like you're saying that from our family to other factors that may contribute to how we respond to the stressors.
In my research, I found that there are really five things that create most anxiety in human beings. Number one would be disruptions, change, loss, separation, accidents, any disruption to normal routine. Secondly would be differences. We're even neurologically geared to see differences, and they just seem to be threatening to us. Third would be uncertainty. We just don't know what's going to happen. Fourth is feeling hostile. Something out there is threatening me. And then finally, feeling trapped. There's nothing I can do to influence the outcome. So I'm hopeless, helpless, powerless. But these seem to be the five major triggers in anybody's life or anxiety. And then, interestingly, with my work with congregations, I discovered that with this emotional system called the congregation, there are 13 universal triggers. That if these things happen, you know there's going to be anxiety within the congregational system.
What are emotional systems? You've used that phrase a few times. I think I have an idea of what that is, but... It's
how we interact with one another based on whether we're going to be reactive or responsive. So part of it has to do with how do we handle our anxiety when we deal with uncertainty, disruptions, feeling helpless, and so forth. And ancient Israel, for instance, was an emotional system. It was based primarily in the purity laws. And if somebody did not follow the purity laws, you could see anxiety in the system. There were set ways to live. There were certain kind of cultural maps, expectations of the people. And when that was not followed, it created a lot of anxiety, especially among those who are most invested in the purity laws. That's why we find in the New Testament such reactivity, again, what I was talking about before, from the religious leaders towards Jesus, because, for instance, he made a major shift when it came to the purity laws, because at that time the Jews believed what went inside you, such as food, etc., could taint you or make you impure, whereas Jesus said, no, it's what comes from within you that makes you pure. That was a major, major shift in people's thinking, and people reacted to it, especially the religious leaders.
How can understanding these things, how can understanding emotional systems, family systems theory, how can that help families today? We'll get to congregations in just a little bit, but how can that be useful for families?
Okay. That question is asked me all the time, and one of the things that frustrates people is family systems don't usually talk about how. If you did this, you did that, you did this, it'll change your thing. It talks more about thinking in this kind of way. In other words, when I know that there are certain things outside in the environment that will arouse my anxiety, it's very natural for me to be anxious. There are certain things that are just going to arouse my anxiety. That's why I've often said anxiety is not an enemy, it's an informer. It tells you, tells us there's something out there that we have estimated to be harmful to us or not in agreement with our way of thinking or doing. So therefore, anxiety is, in some ways, is an ally because then it becomes a motivator for change. But when the anxiety becomes intense and prolonged, it then paralyzes rather than provoke change. So it's a way of understanding what how I function, how I live my life. And the issue is not what somebody else is doing or how they're behaving. The main issue is how am I going to respond to it. So I couldn't say, you know, you're the cause of my problem, okay? Because that would be defining you as the source of my anxiety. My anxiety is my own. When you behave in such a way, it arouses my anxiety. Now, my option is, what am I going to do with this? So it's very helpful in terms of relationships. There's no doubt about it.
It sounds like it's helpful in identifying our feelings and taking our responsibility for our own feelings rather than placing that responsibility
exactly.
on someone else.
Exactly. And that leads actually to a second concept that is important to the theory, taking responsibility for yourself. Actually, Dr. Bowen called it differentiation of self. That's a fancy phrase for really talking about what is human maturity. And he borrowed the phrase differentiation from embryology. In embryology, when a cell differentiates, it is said to be mature. It becomes a muscle cell, a liver cell, a heart cell. A stem cell is something that's immature. It hasn't yet become anything in particular. So differentiation of self really means maturity, taking responsibility for yourself. And Bowen said there's two ways we've got to do that, because there are two deep-seated needs everybody has, the need to stand on his or her own feet and the ability to stay connected to another person. So to be separate and to be close. And how well we negotiate that in a relationship tells us a lot about how the relationship's going to function. And therefore, if I can go on, the problem is for all of us is sometimes we'll go to one or the other extreme. One extreme would be to get too close, and that would be called what he called emotional fusion. You give up something of yourself to take care of the relationship. And fusion is a word from physics. When you melt metals together at certain temperatures, each metal loses its properties. And eventually you can't tell one metal from the other. And that's sort of what emotional fusion is. I use the example, we say when two people marry, they become one, and but we don't know which one, because so often we want the other person to think, feel, and act the same way I do, and vice versa, rather than letting the other person have their own identity. And then the other problem is on the other side, what we call emotional cutoff, or I get too distant from you, and therefore I really can't have contact with you in a relationship.
So being too close or emotionally cut off, both could be problematic.
That's problematic, exactly.
So where would you want to be ideally?
Ideally would be I'm able to define who I am to you. This is how I feel. This is what I think. These are my values. And that's very, very important in the theory, because you act on your principles, you don't act on just instinct. and you can define here, I'm going to define myself. Like Jesus, you know, I am the vine. I am the resurrection. I am the door. That's a defining of self. The second part is probably the hardest part, and that is staying connected to other people, especially when they're reactive or they're not in agreement with us. But that's crucial to maturity. Not to cut off from these people, not to go into some passive-aggressive behavior or give somebody the silent treatment, but I'm still going to stay there with you even though we don't agree. So the third part of it is define self, stay connected, and regulate your anxiety. That's very, very crucial. And I'd say there's a fourth part to it, too, and that is having a clear sense of direction in terms of how you want to function, what you want to accomplish.
Now, regulating anxiety sounds easier said than done to me.
Yes. In fact, Dr. Bowen had a phrase, a lot of people don't like it, but he called it the non-anxious presence. Well, there is no such individual. But really what he was talking about is having some capacity to regulate the instinctive side of life. And actually, in many ways, you look at any religion, and that's one of the things that they propose for people. In Christianity, we call it self-control. How do you have some element of self-control in your life so that the reactive forces don't always take over your behavior? And it is a very difficult task, but you can learn it. And I think that's one of the wonderful things about systems theory. You can always increase your level of differentiation. You can always grow up. There's always a chance for something new in your behavior. But it doesn't always come easy. Sometimes it only can come out of the crucible of more anxiety.
But you can't use the excuse, the devil made me do it.
You can't do that. No, that brings up another point, and that is what is called triangles and triangulation. Bowen said the basic molecule in all human relationships is the triangle, because at some point every dyad becomes unstable. So they bring in a third party to try to restabilize the original dyad. Now, that then is called triangulation. Triangles are just normal. They form all the time. So, for instance, I do interventions with churches in conflict, and I know the minute I move into that system, there are two warring parties, I'm in a triangle. But the key for me is not to get triangulated, which means I'm not going to take responsibility for their functioning. That's their responsibility. I'll be there to do what I need to do to help them, but I'm not going to assume responsibility. So we often like to sometimes triangulate the devil. The devil made me do it. Yeah.
try to place the blame on the
devil. Trace the blame, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Instead of taking responsibility for our own.
As a way to relieve myself from responsibility.
So how can this be, you've alluded to this, how can this be useful to congregations as well?
All right. Now, I have done over 200 interventions with churches in conflict. And it's been with 8 different denominations, 27 different states. This is over 25 years. And for me, when systems get anxious, that's normal. It's not abnormal. The problem is not the presence of the anxiety, it's how we handle it. What do we do with it? And again, a great problem is we get reactive, and then when we get reactive, the other side gets reactive, and it's like a volley in tennis. The reactivity is just going over the net from one side to the other. So my anxious reactivity will only increase your anxious reactivity. So the key is not that you're having some difficulties, because, I mean, arguing with ourselves isn't dysfunctional. It's when we get to the point of attacking each other and blaming each other or cutting off from each other. So it's helpful to realize there are going to be certain stimulants for anxiety in any system. Now, I'll go back to something I said earlier. I know there are 13 triggers of anxiety for congregations. I'll just name a couple of them. money, pastor's leadership style, lay leadership style, staff conflict, staff resignation. And what I usually find is that five or six of these either happen serially or simultaneously. And if they do, then the system should be anxious. It's normal, okay? But the problem becomes the reactivity just it becomes intense, and it festers, and it gets worse rather than better. So that's usually why they then ask for a third party to come in to help us get out of the reactive side and to become more thoughtful. So I say to congregations when they ask me to help them, I want you to remember that I'm here to help you not waste your suffering, because this is an opportunity for learning, not for winning, but for learning. And if you don't learn something, you could easily repeat it again. Because this is another feature of the systems theory, and that is once a pattern of behavior is put into place and is repeated, it's very difficult to change it. Very difficult. Because systems like coherence, and they like stability. They like tranquility.
I appreciate that you said it's not about winning.
But unfortunately, I saw that maybe about 5-6 years ago occurring more often than I'd like. In more recent interventions, that hasn't been necessarily the case. I think some people are saying, you know, we're just tired of feeling this way, or we realize this isn't really our best behavior, and we need to find some way to become more reflective and become about this rather than attacking each other. And I'll say this, Andrew, I always say to people right away, blame doesn't count in this situation. Blame only makes it worse.
What's one practical tip that we can walk away with today for families? If there was just a little snippet of something that you would like for us to walk away with today.
Go back to families. One of the things is put the reflection back on yourself, because it's pretty normal that when we become anxious and more instinctual, we look outside of ourselves, what the other person's doing or not doing, rather than saying, what am I going to do? I remember Dr. Freeman once saying, if somebody is sloppy, if somebody is paranoid in their behavior, that's not what is most important. It is what you will do in response to that. And part of the hard part, again, is how do you stay connected to folks whose behavior is either upsetting or even threatening? So remember this. Your anxiety is the key. How do you hold on to it, or how do you assess it? How do you process it? And keep the reflection back on your functioning, not on how can I get other people to function in a way that is less distressing to me. I think that's one of the real valuable parts of understanding systems theory. I contribute to the problem, and especially I'll contribute to the problem if I'm reactive to your reactivity. I can do something with the problem if I'm not as reactive.
Well, very good. That's been helpful and insightful, and always good to use use these the theory and the instruction, the knowledge that you've gained to help us understand ourselves better in order that we might serve our neighbor better.
Yeah, isn't it amazing how often the opponents of Jesus tried to get him reactive and he refused to get in that position? I guess you could say he was the one non-anxious presence in the world.
Well, thank you, Dr. Steinke,
for being
our guest today. Reverend Dr. Peter Steinke, he's a congregational systems consultant, also served as a parish pastor, educator, and therapist for clergy, and the author of How Your Church Family Works and Healthy Congregations. Dr. Steinke, it's been great talking with you today.
Thank you very much.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.